Excellent. So I chose this cheerful topic of end-of-life treatment in part because this coming week is going to include Zion Other, this next Sunday. So whenever we get around to Zion Other, it's always Chevra Kedisha time, and a time, Vachai Yitein Libo, that we think about these types of issues of taking care of Mason and end-of-life care and things of that variety. It's an interesting phenomenon that this particular area of halacha has seen a lot more activity in the last couple of decades in terms of getting halakhic authorities involved with these determinations of when to administer care, when not to administer care, when people are in end-of-life situations. To some degree, I credit the Mora D'Asra of my shul growing up in Metzi, Rabbi Moshe David Tendler, Zatzal, for bringing to the fore the notion that medicine and halakha go together, and that there's such a thing as medical halakha, and the poskim can play a role in terms of making the determinations regarding time of death, regarding treatment. Certainly it's very relevant, as we know, with respect to Chilul Shabbos, what's permissible, what's not permissible, in order to treat people and the like. And there's really been a tremendously burgeoning field in terms of medical halakha. Some of those who are involved are Dr. Avram Steinberg, who is very close with Rosh Shlomo Zalman Orbach Zatzal. Dr. Steinberg wrote a series of encyclopedic volumes known as sort of the Halacha Refuah Encyclopedia, which is really a one-man show. He really wrote all the articles and all the footnotes himself. Sometimes it's even written in the first person. He's telling personal anecdotes and the like. It's a very, very fascinating encyclopedia. He did such a good job that they then appointed him to be in charge of Encyclopedia Talmudit. So that's one person who's been involved. You have the Nishmas Avraham, of Avraham Sofer Avraham, who's also a tremendous expert in these areas. And you had a lot of weighing in by the postgame of how we deal with many of these situations. It's not a week almost that goes by where I don't get calls, whether in the middle of the day or the middle of the night, from individuals who are maybe people who have loved ones who are in difficult straits, who are Rabbanim, who are dealing with these situations, just asking these types of questions. There's an organization that was formed maybe 8-9 years ago here in Chicago, although it also has chapters throughout the country in other places as well, called Chayim Aruchim. Chayim Aruchim is an organization that's devoted to ensuring that there be halakhic resources for families that are going through a situation of loved ones who are in very desperate straits, those who sometimes require hospice care and the like. One of the things that we did when the Chaim Aruchim chapter of Chicago was created was to develop some sort of a partnership or an association, I should say, with Seasons Hospice, which is one of the hospice programs in the area, that they should gain a sensitivity to the needs of from patients in terms of what we feel is absolutely required, or when the Rabbanim needs to be consulted with and the like. And there are other hospice centers that have also been in consultation with the CRC to develop protocols and standards. And there have been other organizations, even hospitals. St. Francis Hospital put me on some type of a religious ethical task force, and we had a number of meetings in which they wanted to be more sensitive to understanding the Jewish or halakhic approach towards these issues. So there is a lot of interest in really servicing the Jewish community, the observant Jewish community, to understand our viewpoints, for those within our community to really consult more with Rabbanim. So like any other area of halakha, not everything is so black and white, and there are gray areas, and there are also different opinions. There are the different opinions when it comes to what needs to be done, what could be done, what should be done, what shouldn't be done, how much you prolong life when a person is suffering. There's an understanding that at a certain point in time, there's a moment in which it's time to move on, shall we say, for people who have go through Olam Hazeh as the Pruzdor. for Olam Haba, and then there's a time to move on to Olam Haba. So on the one hand, we believe in V'chai Behem, that we're supposed to prolong life, and Pikuach Nefesh Doche, as a call, Pikuach Nefesh Eina Endova Homei B'chnei Pikuach Nefesh, nothing stands in the way of Pikuach Nefesh, of saving lives. Only three cardinal sins, so where a person gives up their life rather than to violate the sins. But otherwise, we try to prolong life as long as we possibly can. At the same time, there's a medrash that says, "Vayar Hashem es kol asher asa b'nei tov me'od," and the Kodesh Baruch Hu created the world, and he saw, "Oh, this is really good." Tov me'od, zu malach hamavis, that having a circle of life that begins at a certain point and ends at a certain point is also a part of the way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu calibrated creation. We understand death came about maybe through the sin of Adam HaRishon, as we understand it, but it was built into the system, this possibility of a Zu Malacha Mavis. There are also Gemaras that talk about how Mavis Totsaot, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created in connection with death, Totsaot, which has the gematria of 903, that there are 903 different ways that a person can die. I don't know that in medical science they've figured out exactly how to apply this to all different types of ways of dying, but it's understood that there are multitudinous ways that people can pass on, and sometimes it can be very, very painful, like pulling the ropes, pulling a ship that's been anchored to the shore with very heavy ropes and pulling the ship away from the ropes, which can be a painful process. And sometimes it could be like plucking a hair out of a saucer of milk, which is considered like a misas nishika, a very pleasant process, or at least a relatively painless process. And the goal, if you look closely at the various sources, is to try to make it painless rather than painful. It's the story of Rabbi Hananya ben Tradion, who is being tortured to death in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah by a Roman executioner. And his Tamidim wanted to know that there were certain woolen tufts that were being placed on his chest in order to make his agony last for as long as possible so he should suffer. They wanted to know whether to remove it. He said that no, it's up to HaKadosh Baruch Hu to end a person's life, and it's not in our hands to do it. But when the executioner offered to do the same thing, so then at that moment in time, he relented, and he said that if the executioner asked, if I would do this, am I going to be promised a place in Olam Haba? And he said that yes, if you do it, then you'll be promised a place in Olam Haba. And there's a question, why is it that it was okay for the executioner to do it, although we're told that when the executioner did it, this basically assured him a place in the world to come. It was in the category of Yesh Kone Olamo B'Sha'acha, said that he earned his place in the world to come in one moment. So why is it that was considered to be okay, as opposed to the directive that Rabbi Hananya ben Tradion gave to his Talmidim, Mutav Shiklenu Mishenasna V'lo Yachvel Hu Bi'atzmo, that it's appropriate for the one who gave me my life, a Kodesh Baruch Hu, to be the one who takes life, and not for us to do it ourselves. So there might be a different standard when it applies to non-Jews than when it applies to Jews. That's something that my Rebbe, Mordechai Willig Shlita, has suggested. And maybe this type of a withdrawal of a treatment for the sake of Rachmanus might be something that was more permissible for the executioner, whatever the explanation may be. Certainly, the upshot of the Gemara is that we see that it was considered to be ultimately a praiseworthy thing to figure out what steps to take in order for Rabbi Hananya ben Tradion's passing from this world to the next to be a more pleasurable journey and not to be such a painful journey. So there seem to be contradictory passages and in the Gemara and in Chazal, and much of the discussion regarding end-of-life treatment has to do with how you reconcile the different passages. So on the one hand, you have the Gemara in Yuma, which is the first source. These sources, when I collected them a number of years ago, I collected them for a diverse audience that I thought would also benefit from English translations. So you have the benefit of the English translations. I think some I took from existing translations and some I did on my own. But this Gemara says that kol sapek nepashas dochas a Shabbos, that whenever there's a sapek, whether a person is alive, so we violate Shabbos. And this is even when an avalanche falls on somebody. An avalanche falls on somebody, so they're probably not going to last too long. That's what the Gemara says. The Mishnah had said, Matsu chai mefakin, that we're going to uncover the avalanche even on Shabbos if we see the person is breathing. So the Gemara says, even if it's a suffix, but it says the Gemara, Matsu chai mefakin, why is it that we can clear all the stones and violate any number of potential Shabbos violations in order to save the person's life, to clear them away from the rubble? They're not going to last too long. They were completely crushed by the rubble. If their heart's still beating, they're not going to last more than a couple of minutes or a couple of hours. So the Gemara says, obviously, if they were fully alive and they're viable, we understand, of course, you can save their life. So the Chiddush is exactly this case. No, we see that even if the person is in the process of expiring, nonetheless, you have to do everything you can in order to prolong their life. Now, this raises an interesting question, because it seems it's very likely that a person who is buried underneath rubble might, in fact, be suffering very terribly. And yet we see that we are Mechal Shabbos. We go so far, this isn't even just a question of prolonging the life during the weekday. This is, we're going to prolong the life even on Shabbos when we're going to be Mechal Shabbos. The Gemara seems to indicate this is what you're supposed to do, even if the person is going to suffer terribly, because the main goal that we have under all circumstances, it seems, is that we want to extend the person's life. We do everything that we can in order to extend the person's life. And we have to refrain from any kind of action that even when the soul is ebbing away, the body is ebbing away from the soul, even at that moment in time, we are not allowed to do the slightest action that could hasten a person's death. That's considered to be shvichos damim. That's considered to be an act of murder. That's the Gemara in Shabbos. Daf Kuf Nun Gimel Amin Aleph. Mishnah says, Eima Atzmin Esameis B'Shabbos. You're not allowed to close the eyes of a dead person B'Shabbos. How somehow the practice developed that people do this anyway is a separate question that the Mishnah Berurah talks about. But simple reading of the halacha. But below b'chol im yitzias nefesh. And then the Mishnah goes further and says that as the person is dying, you're not allowed to do that. Forget about Shabbos for a second. Even during a weekday, you can't do that. Why is that? Because the person's not dead yet. You're going to touch a person who's a goses, person who's in the final moments of their life, and you're going to fiddle with their limbs any tiny little bit. This could be the makeh b'patish, so to speak. This could be the final blow, that or the final touch that's going to cause their death to occur. If you do this, that you even cause a fluttering of the eye as the soul is leaving the body, that's considered to be shvikos damim. It's considered to be an act of murder. The Gemara explains, Mashal in Ershakovet Be'olechus. It's like a flickering flame. You have a flickering flame, and you just put your finger slightly over the flame. You didn't even do that much, and the flame goes out. You cause the flame to be extinguished. Other minyak et spoleh miyad kofsum. And therefore, you have to avoid doing anything that would be an active type of motion that would cause a person to expire. Clearly, this is understood by the poskim means that one thing which is completely off limits is a notion of active euthanasia. Active euthanasia you can't do. But Baron Soloveitchik used to point out, we have the pasuk in Parshas Noach that says, "Miyad achas timchem l'nafshos seichem edrosh." Miyad isha chiv edrosh es nefesh adam. I'm going to exact a person's responsibility for committing an act of a murder. I will exact the appropriate punishment against such a person. Edrosh miyad isha chiv edrosh. Why does it say miyad isha chiv? A person who kills his brother. So he means even if you're doing it as an act of brotherly love. Even if you're doing it as an act of mercy killing, that you're just going to have a little bit of a touch to hasten the person's death because you know that the person is suffering extensively, and you wanted to bring an end to their suffering, if you're going to do anything which is active, so that for sure is going to be considered to be murder from a halakhic perspective. That is the starting point.
Are we distinguishing the Raisa and Rabbana? Murder the Raisa, murder the Rabbana?
We're assuming murder the Raisa. Murder the Raisa.
How do we know? It's not, maybe it's Rabbana, maybe in Mishnah.
Haraisa Shofech Damim is a lashon of Daraisa. Shofek Dama Dama Dam.
So
Damoji Shofek. That's so, it's a lashon of Daraisa.
So we don't have Rabbanon. We don't have Rabbanon Gedar Siyarim of murder.
It's a very good question. It's a very good question. But here, when we speak about murder, we mean murder on a Daraisa level. Pashtus, unless it's explicitly said other ways. We could talk about Groma, whether a person who indirectly causes death is responsible for the death, but even Groma for murder is probably something which is a problem on a Daraisa level as well. Now, those are the sources that teach us that we prolong life under all circumstances, and we do everything that we can not to extinguish life, because that's Shvikos Damim. But then we have the Gemara in Ksuvos, Daf Kufa, a Dalet and an Aleph, and the question is, what do we do with the Gemara in Ksuvos? Gemara in Ksuvos talks about the last days, last moments of Rebbe's life, last days of Rebbe's life. So Rebbe is the big Rosh Yeshiva, he's the Gadol Ador, so he's in the process of dying. So what are the Tamidim doing? What do you think the Tamidim are doing when their Rebbe, the Gadol Ador, is in dire straits? They're saying, tell him, they're praying, davening with all their might and all their strength and all their vocal cords, as much as they possibly can, in order to keep Rebbe alive. And it seems like this is a nice thing to do. So who was with Rebbe at the time? Naturally, his caretaker. People had caretakers back then as well. So this was his handmaid, his caretaker, the handmaid of Rebbe, went up to the roof, and she said that this is Elyon Mevakshim is Rebbe, Vatakton Mevakshim is Rebbe, that the forces up high want Rebbe to be taken away and to die, but the forces below, the Tamidim, want him to live. I want him to live too. Yirasim Shekupu Taktonim Es Elyonim. Let the Tamidim, let their prayers be efficacious. But then, Kivin the Chas and Kamizimni, the Isle of Esakise, the Cholach Tfilin, the Monach Lahu, the Grinstayer, she saw the tremendous incontinence that he had, she saw the tremendous discomfort that he had, the Gemara speaks. However, it gets the point across, that he had to constantly go to the bathroom, to constantly take off his tefillin. He was suffering. The point is that he was suffering terribly, and there was no relief to the suffering that he had. So she realized that it would be better that we not prolong the dying process. Here is where we find the important halakhic distinction between the notion of prolonging life, which is very much a goal and very much a strong value in Judaism, v'chai behem, lo shiyomus behem, versus prolonging death, where the Gemara here indicates very strongly, we don't believe in prolonging death. No, let the upper forces that are trying to take Rebbe away, let the upper forces succeed. It's time for Rebbe to go. He's suffering too much. However, he couldn't go, because the Tamidim keep on davening and davening and davening. They're good at davening. They're good. The Tehillim are very good. So what did she do? She took a shakla kuzia, she took an earthenware jug, she threw it from the roof to the ground. So they heard the loud noise, the Tamidim stopped praying for a second. That was good enough. So Rebbe Sol was able to peacefully depart. What?
Like the story with David HaMelech.
Very much so. Except here, it wasn't just a Malach HaMavis that was being sent to take away David HaMelech from this world, but it was Rebbe's maid. It was a human being that actually intervened. She intervened. But she didn't intervene by taking away his intravenous. She didn't intervene by removing anything that was bodily keeping him going.
It was totally Groma.
Right. This was maybe in less than Groma, because of the fact that she didn't do anything to him directly. She simply, this is what we call a Hesaris Hamonea. Hesaris Hamonea, she took away some outside external force that was preventing Rebbe from dying. So it wasn't any kind of an active force, it was a passive force, it was a passive action. That now this was, she caused there to be a passive silence so that the Tamidim would not continue to pray, which was keeping Rebbe alive. So you could say, okay, it's an agadata. We're not necessarily going to paskin halacha based on this agadata that it's ever permissible to engage in some sort of passive intervention in order to enable somebody to die. But the Ran says, no, this is halacha l'maisa. Says the Ran in the Durim Daf Mem Amud Aleph, he's talking about how it's good to be dubika cholim, to visit people. So if you don't visit people, you're not going to be able to pray for their well-being, to know what types of tefillos they need in order to recover. And as we know that the prayers, al eres devai, which are uttered and recited in the presence of the sick person, are considered to be more efficacious. The Shekhinah is found over there. It says, the Ran, you're also not going to know to render the appropriate prayers if it is appropriate to render a prayer, that the person should move on and that they should be allowed to die. Because sometimes that is the prayer that is supposed to be rendered. An incredible statement. That sometimes it is appropriate that you should pray for the chole, that he should actually die. That's what he says. Sometimes this is what needs to be done. Like, for example, if the chole is suffering terribly in terms of his or her sickness, the efshalosh yichya. Like it says in Gemara and Ksubos, that the chazak kiven the chazak yamsi the Rebbe dal kamazimun veisakisa and atzvilan kamistar. When the handmaid of Rebbe saw that Rebbe was suffering so terribly, Amar Yiratzon shekupo al yonim asataklonim, she prayed that he should be allowed to die. So we see from here that this is an appropriate thing to do. So it says of Shlomo Zalman Orbach, you can't necessarily derive from here that if it's appropriate, according to the Ran, to engage in prayer sometimes that a person dies, that means that you should take affirmative steps to see to it that the person not receive treatment. You could still argue that you should give every single medical treatment that's possible to the individual, but privately you also daven that the person die. So that, to some people, they say, that sounds like a little bit of a tarti disaster. You're going to pray the person dies, but at the same time you're going to administer every single possible medical treatment. So it could very well be that maybe there are other possible distinctions that would be at play over here. But Moshe Feinstein says that you have to be careful who's going to be involved in making this type of a prayer, because if the prayer is uttered by family members, so sometimes they're a little bit worn out from all of the caretaking that they need to do. So even if they think that they're doing it l'shem shemayim, we're not going to trust them to render a prayer that the person die, even though we know that they have the person's best interest at heart. They shouldn't render this prayer. Shlomo Zalman Orbach says nobody should render it nowadays. We're not on that level of tzikus to know when we should daven that a person dies. The Be'er Moshe, of Moshe Stern, the Debrett Zina Rebbe, has a beautiful comment. He says, you know what you do? You say the following prayer. Say HaKadosh Baruch Hu should save this person from their pains in whatever is the best possible way. That's the prayer that should be rendered. That's sort of the consensus. I think that this is a prayer that's appropriate.
That's what we do in hospice. We say we're praying for comfort.
Yes.
We're praying for comfort.
Very good. So that's exactly along the lines, very good, of what the Debrett Zina Rebbe said. At the same time, what do we do with that sugya in Ksuvos in terms of how it's actually going to be applied? So here you have really three different approaches amongst the poskim. You have the approach of Moshe Feinstein, you have the approach of Shlomo Zalman Orbach, and you have the approach of the Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg. Now, within each of these approaches, you'll find nuanced variations amongst the different poskim of applying these approaches to different degrees and in a different fashion. But by and large, those are the three main approaches that I can find. And they really have to do with the degree to which you understand the Gemara and Ksuvos as a very practical halacha lemaise instruction that sometimes it is appropriate and it is even recommended to withhold treatment that just like the handmaid of Rebbe understood it was a time for the davening to end. So the Rama, really, if going back to a more classical source, if you look in source 8, so the Rama really seems to take this to its logical conclusion, even in the Shulchan Aruch, his commentary to the Shulchan Aruch in Yeridea, Simen Shin Lamentes, with respect to the laws of Bikkur Cholim. So he quotes, he says as follows, As we said from the sugi and Shabbos, you can't do anything to hasten a person's death. Person's having trouble dying. You can't pull the pillow from out under him, and that's going to create a stir in the body and the breathing. So now the person will die because that's murder. So that you can't do. I have no idea what this is. You shouldn't put the keys of the Beis Knesses under his head because that's some sort of metaphysical way of hastening death. However, but if there is something external that's causing the death to be delayed unnecessarily, like there's a woodcutter. There's a wood chopper who is chopping his wood near the hospital, and the sound of the chopping of the wood is keeping the person alive. It's somehow that sensory that sensory stimulation is keeping the body alive. So then mutar lasiru misham. So then you're allowed to get the wood chopper to stop chopping his wood. He has an example of removing salt that happens to be on the tongue, but that's a machlokas achronim, because some say that's not a passive thing, that's an active thing, so the Taz says that you would not be allowed to do. However, certainly to get the wood chopper to stop chopping his wood, so that there won't be this distraction, and then the soul will be able to move on peacefully, because this is elishemesev amoneya. This is based on the Shiltei Agiborim in Moed Katan. This is considered to be a hasaras amoneya. So comes along Moshe Feinstein. This is source 11. We'll jump around a little bit. Moshe Feinstein says that we see from these sugyos that there is a time, the time comes, leis mitzvah, there is a time in which it's appropriate to withhold a further treatment. So here, take a look. Hinei b'dorim yesh anashim kolim ke'elu, she'elitein lehem eisim nei refuas la'ari chayem tzas yoyser. He says that there are some very sick people. You're going to give them medicine, you're going to give them treatment, whatever it is. You're going to give them extraordinary treatment. It's just going to prolong the agony. Hinei mefurish b'ksuvos. He says, I'm going to utilize that gemara in ksuvos for halakha l'maisa. The Talmidim were keeping him alive. He wasn't going to get cured. He was just going to continue to suffer in agony. Obviously, the Rebbe should start tuba. When the Shifka Rebbe saw he suffering terribly, she said, it's time for him to go. So she threw up a jug from the roof to the ground, and then he was able to move on. So therefore, he says that in this type of a situation, when the expert doctors, Moshe was very big on expert doctors, you should know, say just stam doctors, you have to get expert opinions, but when the expert doctors say the person is not going to be able to be cured, the person is just going to die, they're terminal, and they're just, if you keep them alive and you're going to give them extraordinary measures in order to remain alive, they're going to suffer terribly. Says, do not give this additional medicine to the individual. Leave the person alone. You can't give them sami refuas. You can't give them an extra dosage of morphine, so the person's definitely going to die because that's what we call active euthanasia. You wouldn't not be allowed to do that. You can't even do anything that's going to strip the person of their life for 1 second. Rather, you just have the right at a certain point and the responsibility. Like the Talmidim, it was not appropriate for them to continue davening. So at a certain point, it's appropriate to stop administering the treatment. However, says Ramosha, this is very important, and this is where we get to palliative care. About Mika Same Rape, like in the case of Rabbi Konanya Mentradion, we try to alleviate a person's suffering. You have certain drugs, certain types of medications that can provide palliative care, so the person doesn't have to suffer. Shiakilu ayisun v'lo yitzru abregim echayev. As long as those measures are not going to shorten the person's life. Sometimes with morphine you don't know, but Shlomo Zalman says just be careful not to administer a lethal dosage. You give a dosage with that, the person could continue to live, but they're also going to be more comfortable. Sarak lasas kasher dayin eno goses. So then you have to continue administering the treatment as long as the person is not a gosis in the final moments. The final moments, you're not allowed to touch the person altogether. So you could do something to cure the person, even if they're a gosis, so make them live again, wonderful. But if it's not something that's going to cause them to live, it's just palliative care. So they says that you don't give to a gosis. How do we define a gosis nowadays? A gosis, person who's in their death rattle, the way that it was defined for me by Rav Shechter's father, Melech Shechter, said the person in their death rattle, the last moments of life. So generally it was defined as a person who's in the last 3 days of his life. So Dr. Steinberg asked Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, how does that translate nowadays? We have so many life prolonging measures. In the olden days they would have died within 3 days, but now you can keep them alive. So Shlomo Zalman Auerbach responded, Atah Rofe, you're the doctor, what are you asking me? Hard nowadays to define goseis exactly, but that's what he says. However, says Rav Moshe, there are certain necessary things that have to be administered. The chola mesukan shenu yachol linshom, tzarech liten lo oxygen. If a person can't breathe, he says, one thing that's non-negotiable is oxygen, because if you're going to deprive somebody from oxygen, I think what Rav Moshe was saying is depriving somebody of oxygen is just giving them a tremendous amount of suffering. So therefore, since you have to administer palliative care, he says you can't take a person off oxygen. So this is where there's a certain category that was read into the poskim, but Moshe, Shlomo Zalman, even if extraordinary treatments are going to be withheld, in certain situations where a person is suffering terribly, you cannot withhold oxygen, nutrition, or hydration. There are certain basics that every single person is entitled to have. Now, recently, Rav Herschel Schechter Shlita, Rav Mordechai Willig Shlita have qualified this somewhat. They say, really what Rav Moshe was getting at, and they're reading anyway, was that you have to keep the person comfortable. The person's not going to have oxygen, so they're not going to be comfortable, not going to have nutrition, hydration, but if under the circumstances they could be kept comfortable, and giving them this stuff is just going to make things more problematic for them, it's going to fill up fluid in their lungs and who knows what else, so then under those circumstances there aren't necessarily any non-negotiables. However, the big issue is the idea of disconnecting somebody from a ventilator. Used to be when a person was connected to a respirator, eventually the oxygen would run out, and Rav Moshe would say, okay, you're not obligated to refill it, but now it just keeps on going automatically by itself. So once you have sort of the standard that you can't withdraw, you can withhold, but you're not allowed to withdraw, you can't disconnect somebody from the oxygen, so then you put a lot of families in a dilemma nowadays. Families say, listen, we want to follow the halacha, and it's a question whether intubate somebody, whether you're going to connect them to the ventilator, and halakhically, it might very often be prescribed that you should do it, especially if it appears that the person could really recover eventually. They might be in very, very bad shape, but they have the ability to recover. But a family is worried, you're going to put them on the intubator, you're going to intubate them, you're going to connect them to a respirator, that they'll never be able to be disconnected, and then they'll just be struggling and suffering there forever, especially if you don't have the right to pull the plug, so to speak. There was one authority, Rav Chaim David Alevi, who was the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, who suggested maybe there's no real difference between withholding and withdrawing when it comes to pulling the plug, because it's also passive. You're just preventing more oxygen from coming in. But most poskim assume that pulling the plug is pulling the plug. If that's considered to be active euthanasia, that you would not be allowed to do.
What about putting a timer on it?
Yeah, but that's so the Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg, said, let's do a Shabbos clock. A Shabbos clock that it will just go off automatically by itself at a certain point in time, and then you don't have to restart it. So to the extent that the intensive care units of hospitals have Shabbos clocks in which they're putting people, you know, on the ventilators, that it's fine. By all means, one can avail themselves of it. I haven't come across it too much in terms of the way that most hospitals function nowadays. So the big question nowadays has become, at what point in time do you take a person off of a ventilator for other reasons that you need to check them out, they need to go through a procedure, or maybe they're checking to see whether the person has the ability to breathe on their own, and at what point do you have an obligation to put them back on? So some say that you can only take them off if there's a reasonable confidence that they can breathe on their own for 48 hours. Some say 24 hours. I don't know that there's any magical formula about this. I asked Rabbi Willig about it. He said, look, if it's only 1 minute and the person is struggling for air, so then you have to put them back on, obviously. But if there's some sort of reasonable time frame in which it's not being taken off for the sake of killing them or the sake of hastening their demise, but really for seeing whether they can breathe on their own, and then after some period of time, it becomes difficult, so one does not necessarily have to put them back on as long as it was as it was reasonable to take them off in the first place. Rabbi Willig also has an idea that he said was approved by Rosh Shlomo Zalman Orbach and by Rosh Shmuel Vosner, which is that you don't necessarily, I'm not a medical expert, he said you don't necessarily have to put somebody on 100% oxygen. People in this world aren't necessarily on their own coming up with 100% oxygen. It's a much lower amount that they're generating on their own. So you can have the machine, the ventilator, mimic whatever that amount is. It could be much less than 100%, and that also will enable them to pass on, even if they're connected to the ventilator, much more readily and much more easily.
So you can decrease the oxygen?
You can have it decreased. As long as it is a reasonable amount of oxygen that a healthy person would be able to subsist upon under normal circumstances.
That's a very big
question. Isn't that a big thing,
a healthy person as opposed to a sick person?
Yes, I think that it is a big question mark, and Rav Schechter is not a fan of this particular approach. I find it curious myself, but I think that the idea behind it is the correct sentiment, which is that you don't want people and families to make the decision not to connect to the respirator in the first place because they feel they're going to be stuck forever. So what I generally tell people is that if it's a situation that warrants intubating a person, putting them on the ventilator, giving them the oxygen, I say, do that and don't worry about them being stuck forever. We'll figure it out. That's what I say. And generally speaking, you're able to figure it out, especially if you're a little bit more makele about the circumstances in which you can disconnect and check and see if the person can manage it and live on their own, or you're cleaning out the equipment or something like that.
Room air is 21%.
21% is the amount that I heard from everyone.
That's room air.
So, right. So he suggests that you can put them on as little as 21%.
Wow.
So again, I am not endorsing, advocating, or anything of the sort. I'm just giving you sort of the range of opinions. If this is what's necessary in order to convince people to do it in the person, you start with 100%, whatever, you see how it's going. So I think this is something to consider. Now, the Stifler Gaon, Rabbi Yaakov Kanievsky, was dealing with this issue, and we know of it that if you want somebody who sort of stands for the Haredi world and sort of the official positions of the Haredi world, very few assume that mantle as well as the Stifler Gaon, Bishaito. The Stifler Gaon says something very fascinating, which I think we can all relate to on some level. It says, this idea you have to do everything to extend the life. I also heard that that's what we Jews believe in. Do everything that you can to keep a person going every last possible second. But he said, you know what? I don't actually know if it's true. That's something I was told. It was something I was brought up with. It was something they taught us in Cheder. Something that everybody said, but I don't know. Look at the Ramah that we just read. It says there that when a person is suffering terribly, you get the wood chopper to stop chopping his wood, you take away these types of external items that are preventing the soul from moving on. There's a Beis Lechem Yehuda on the side of Shulchan Aruch. It says that sometimes the suffering is not just physical suffering. You can have a person who appears to be completely unconscious, comatose, and you don't necessarily, the doctors may say, we don't think the person is suffering or feeling anything at all. And he says the soul is suffering. The soul is suffering that the soul wants to leave already. And the soul is, there's also something you have to take into account. Farak Maise Begufo Hasil Asos Nimkein Leo Shevi Altase the Chayra Mamat Sasi Yisr. So he says that to do nothing, obviously, that it's not going to lead to more yisurim. It shouldn't lead to yisurim. It should be a low. Lo matzasi yisur. There's I did not find any prohibition. That the Beis Lechem Yehuda says the same thing, that we're not supposed to keep on muchering somebody, which is a term of art that I've heard recently. You don't keep on muchering the person that they're going to keep on suffering forever. And therefore he says that there's a very strong argument that you don't have to constantly take these life prolonging measures. So, that's along the lines of what Rav Moshe Feinstein basically says.
Is the stifler saying that if someone is deemed to be terminal, that you don't have to hear this, it can stop?
He's saying that the person, we're talking about a terminal person. We're talking about a terminal person who's in the process of dying. My chaver, Rabbi Sobolovsky Shlita, says that if you look at a sort of the combination of sources that we've looked at in terms of the considerations of when to withhold treatment, so there are really three different things over here. One is that it has to be just that you're passively withholding something as opposed to actively doing something. It's going to hasten the demise. The second thing is that there's a certain pain element, that the person is suffering terribly. And the third is that the things that you're withholding are unnatural things. They're extraordinary measures. They're additional treatments as opposed to the basics in terms of oxygen and nutrition and hydration. Those are sort of the major formulas. Now, as I said, there are different opinions about how much you can ship away. Even he says that if it's a natural process, it's going to cause a person a tremendous amount of suffering, like you're going to force feed the person, and that's going to cause the person's lungs to fill up, or something like that. It's going to cause more stuff. It's going to cause more problems than solutions. So then even the natural things don't necessarily get administered. Rav Moshe says, by the way, as a matter of course, Rav Moshe says that we don't force feed people. If a person is clearly rejecting a particular treatment, so we don't force it upon them in terms of forcing a feeding tube or something like that. Shlomo Zalman Orbach, not as much. Shlomo Zalman says if it's warranted, well, what do you mean? Sometimes you save a person's life against their will. It doesn't say that as much. But Moshe certainly feels that way. With the idea, in terms of the amount of oxygen, there might be a precedent for what Rabbi Willig is saying in the Lashon of Moshe. If you look towards the end of page 5, the second to last line, V'kem shol yenika im yamos, tzarech ha'nika v'chamson, kima kima she'kopam l'shah achas u'shtayim. That what you do is that you give the person small doses. That's what he said. You give the person small doses of oxygen. And then you check on him. You see if he's still alive, you give a little bit more. If he's no longer alive, then you don't have to give more. So he has this idea of kima kima, again, being applied in a different context. Now, Mashlom is on.
All these different attainments, and that knows a very wide range. You mentioned one of the factors is the patient has to be in pain. So you have people, for example, that are, let's not talk about brain death, it's complicated. They're in a comatose state. They're terminal, have no chance of recovery, but they might be comfortable because they're fully unconscious. You can't detect any signs of pain with their heart or anything else. Yet they're just sitting there for weeks, months on end.
So Poskim say two things, okay? Some would say, well, the person is fine and therefore give them full treatment. Others say, we don't know how much suffering a person really has. We can't trust. The person's in very, very bad straits. So don't assume that the person's not suffering. And a third approach is to say, like the Beis Lechem Yehuda, the soul is in agony. The neshamos, sometimes the amalgamation of the circumstances is such that you see the soul is suffering. Now, look at Shlomo Zalman Orbach. This is source 12, Mincha Shlomo, Chelek Aleph, Simin Sari Aleph. He says, Rabbi Mislaptim, Mishela Zusha Tipu, Bechola Gosin. Many don't know what to do with somebody who is in their last straits. Some say you have to force somebody who's very, very sick to take treatment. Because he's not the owner of his life. Life belongs to a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Our bodies belong not to us, but our bodies belong to God. That's the approach that the Tzitz Eliezer, the Rabbi Eliezer Yudin Waldenberg, takes. He doesn't take that approach. He says, Ach Mistabir, it stands to reason. Rabbi Shlomo Zalman was a very reasonable person. The person is suffering terrible, or it's even psychological pain because of their physical state. Nutrition and hydration, oxygen, you got to give him. No, this is where we have his lashon. He says even against his will. That's a very strong statement. But the additional types of medicines that are going to prolong the agony of the person's dying, if the chola says, I don't want any more, the chola has certain autonomy. The chola has the right. Moshe Feinstein says the same thing, chola autonomy. when the Chaim Aruchim, we had wonderful shiurim, a representative of Chaim Aruchim came to speak at the CRC, but he wasn't talking about patient autonomy at all. So I asked him about that. He said, no, we don't understand what they mean. All right, I don't know. But my own debate and feel that it means something. It means something, this idea of patient autonomy. The patient says that they're suffering too much, that they can't take anymore. Shlomo Zalman, however, says, one second, he says, if the chole is God-fearing, he says that it's good to explain to him that the suffering will be a good kapara for him, if he's able to handle it. But he's not able to handle it, if she's not able to handle it, so then nobody is, a person's allowed to say, lo hein velo sacharim. The person's allowed to say that they don't want this particular kapara. But Moshe doesn't have this notion of trying to convince the person. If a Moshe assumes that most people would not want, that the default position, even if the person has not actually expressed it, the default position is that they're not going to want the prolonged agony. Right. Yes, question.
So would that apply then with patient autonomy and the guy, the patient says, you know, I don't want anything more. Would that apply to the surrogate?
What do you mean by the surrogate? Well, you mean the person who has the power of attorney?
The power of a
Yes, in other words, if the chole has appointed somebody, given them the power of attorney in their lifetime to make be their healthcare proxy,
right,
to make those types of determinations, it means that this is the person that they trust, that they feel this person knows their preferences and what they want, and you'll be able to rely upon that. Unless sometimes people just get it dead wrong. I always tell people when they ask me these questions, I start by saying, what do the doctors recommend? I try to talk to the doctors as well. What do the doctors recommend? I say, the doctors think that it's kedai, that it's worthwhile to try some sort of a life-prolonging treatment because they think it's going to potentially cure the person in some meaningful way. I said, you got to take that seriously. That usually you can't start the conversation with me unless the doctors have given up. And the doctors say that it's not worthwhile. So then I say, we can have a conversation about whether whether you want to do it anyway, whether you don't want to do it anyway. I said, if the doctors say it's advisable, I'm not one to overrule doctors in terms of their medical judgment when they think that they can actually do something that's going to be efficacious for the person. But sometimes you just have to apply a luck against the doctors. I had a case of a fellow that we knew. He was had serious heart problems. This is going back 8-9 years ago or so. And he was on a ventilator. He had some very difficult episode, and he couldn't breathe. And he looked like he was completely out of it. And they wanted to pull the plug. They wanted to pull the plug, but they knew that we were close to my wife's family in particular was very close to a fellow on the East Coast. And therefore, they contacted the rabbi and Rebbetzin of the family. They got through to us, and they asked me about it. And I told the relatives of this fellow, you can't authorize the pulling of the plug because it's against the law. Well, they weren't Orthodox. The fellow we know is like a Baal Tshuva, but they said they weren't Orthodox. They were ready to pull the plug. So I said, listen, do me a favor. Wait 24 hours and see. Sometimes there's like a little bit of a change. Maybe you'll see a little bit of movement. Said the doctors say that his brain will be so severely damaged that there's no point in even trying to keep him going. I said, you never know. Let's give it 24 hours. And then 24 hours later, they see a little bit of movement. What do you know? They don't have to disconnect him. A week later, take him off of the ventilator entirely. And Baruch Hashem, he's 100% back to his old cranky self. And he's 100% normal, like he was before. And they were ready to pull the plug, and nothing wrong with his brain. Not one iota was there anything wrong with his brain. So you sometimes can't just trust, you know, judgment or instincts. The halacha saves you from bad decisions sometimes. The fact the halacha said you don't pull the plug, that's what saved us. So I said, we can't do that. We have to wait. And the Baruch Hashem, the person was perfectly fine. Now, Rabbi Eliezer, Yehuda, should live a merit. Now, Rabbi Eliezer, Yehuda, Waldenberg, has a totally different approach. And there are certain poskim. I think his approach probably is more akin to what we were hearing, you know, in the certain sectors of our population, namely the idea of that you do everything, even if the person wants to discontinue treatment. Nonetheless, you take a look at the second paragraph. He says, "Puchazi alachem efereshes b'shulchan aruch v'mechalan es haShabbos apilo misha matzu merutzatz." Even if a person's skull was crushed, so it says in Hilchos Shabbos that you save his life on Shabbos. Why? The person's not even going to have any cognition, so what's the basis for keeping the person alive? The person with a crushed skull is not going, there's a Gemara in Gittin that says sometimes you save somebody, they're going to be able to at least say vidoy and get their affairs in order, the person won't be able to do anything. He's just going to suffer terribly. Nonetheless, you have to continue the person's life as much as possible. Even if you're going to violate Shabbos, Rabbi Willig says sometimes the halacha is that you can violate Shabbos because Amish Batei Atayra Nekama Ba'olam Elarachamim V'chesed V'shalom Ba'olam, like the Rambam says that with Shabbos was not given, that it would make it prohibited for us to save somebody's life. But at the same time, even if it would be during the week, we might make a determination with this person that it's time to let the person go and not to intervene. It's not a contradiction. The fact that the Torah, on the one hand, we're being told that you can violate Shabbos in order to save a person's life, regardless of the circumstance, not a contradiction. That sometimes, even if it's not Shabbos and there's no chilul Shabbos involved, you'll still decide that you're going to withhold further treatment because it's just going to prolong extraordinary agony for the individual. But the Tzitz Eliezer sort of is a kasha, so it's a reasonable kasha. What about the halacha in the Ramah that we see that you're allowed to take away the woodcutter? It says the woodcutter is not medical support. The woodcutter is not medical treatment. That's not chemotherapy. That's some sort of a seguli type of thing that the woodcutting keeps a person alive, a tfilos keeps a person alive. That's spiritual. So to withdraw, spiritual intervention, no problem. He agrees. Sometimes you can withdraw the spiritual and metaphysical intervention. We have the right to do that. But in terms of the medical treatment, he says you have no right to withdraw medical treatment. That's the approach of the Tzitz Eliezer. Take a look at the last paragraph here. He says, a person's life is not their own. It belongs to Hashem, as it says in the Pashas Lihena. And certainly not up to the parents or for the children to make a decision about their child or their parent or when they're going to discontinue treatment. He was talking about a specific case. We have the din of Rapo Yerapo. Let the doctor do his job and then let whatever Kodesh Baruch Hu decides. They have to do everything, including procedures, surgeries, chemotherapies, whatever it is. And you have to save the person from dying. Even it's going to be very, very difficult. Because he quotes from the Baal HaTanya, who says that a person has no reshus with respect to his own body. That's the famous source of the essay that was written by Shlomo Zevin about the Shylock contract, which he said. He said the Shylock, the merchant of Venice, contract in which Antonio said, hey, if I don't pay you up, you can take a pound of flesh, was not a valid contract according to Jewish law, because a person, you can't make a contract with respect to your own body. It's not your own, that's your own possession. Famous essay by Rav Zevin that spawned the whole literature of reactions, responses by Shaul Yisraeli, others as well. So those are basically the three approaches that we have. We have Rav Moshe Feinstein, who says a person is suffering terribly, so it's not even a good idea, the chatzchila, to administer extraordinary life-prolonging measures. The person insists on it. Okay, obviously it's a different story. It's what the person wants. But otherwise, the assumption is that it's not appropriate. It's not a good idea for the person. And with a tremendous emphasis on palliative care. That you have to give the proper care in order to make sure the person is comfortable. Because we believe a person should be comfortable when they pass on from this world. Why should they suffer? Shlomo Zalman Orbach, who says a person has a patient autonomy, but we encourage the person to agree to life prolonging measures anyway as much as possible, because it will give him a kapara. It will give the person a kapara. Both of them seem to indicate that the things that are absolutely necessary, treatments in terms of oxygen, nutrition, and hydration should be administered, as I mentioned. There are certain contemporary opinions of Schechter, Rabbi Willig, who temper that a little bit. In terms of force feeding, Moshe is against it, Rav Shlomo Zalman seems to indicate that even that could be warranted if it's a situation where we feel that the prolonged treatment is going to be good for the person, at least provides necessary breathing and necessary nutrition, so the person doesn't have to starve to death or suffocate, God forbid. And then you have the opinion of Rabbi Eliezer Yehuda Woldenberg, who says nothing doing with respect to any kind of withholding of treatments, but rather you have to do every single thing up until last minute to keep the person alive, even if it's going to cause a tremendous amount of suffering. Would there be a line even for Rabbi Eliezer Yehuda Woldenberg? I assume so. Everybody has a gavul. There's a certain line where it's just clear that you have to allow the process to play itself out, where you're really, really holding at the very, very end. Is there any right or wrong in this discussion? I think each opinion has a certain place, and each opinion has a certain amount of validity. You look at source 14 in terms of the story, a very poignant story of Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi was getting ready to die. So Amalei the Malach Hamavis Zil Avdei Rusei. They said to the Malach Hamavis, show Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi the nice place he's going to have in heaven. So the Malach Hamavis showed him. So Amalei Havli Sakinech. So Yeshua ben Levi said, you know, I'm checking out my place, but it's kind of scary watching you holding that giant knife, that giant scythe. Whatever, Dilma Basisli Mi Barucha, I might be fearful during the journey. So please give me your knife. Give me your knife. You know, the Grim Reaper thing, it's kind of spooking me out. So Yavin Yare, so he gave him the knife of the Malach Hamavis. Kimata Lahasam. So afterwards, he said, I would like to look at the second to last line. That the Malach Hamavis asked for the knife back, and he didn't want to give the knife to the Malach Hamavis. Nafka Bas Kala Ve'amalei Basko came out from heaven and said, Harmialei the Misvar the Viyasa. He said to Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, give the knife back to the angel of death because he needs it to attend to the other people on earth. What's going on over here? What's going on is a sort of the natural reaction and response of Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi is registering that is consonant with halacha, which is that we want to do away with that knife of the Malach Hamavis. We want to do away Bila Mavis Lanetzach, Umach Hashem and Bedima Me'al Koponim. That's what we always say. We want to do away with it. That's an absolutely valid sentiment. Says the Kodesh Baruch Hu, I'll decide when the time comes that Bila Mavis Lanetzach. The time will come. The time will come. But until that time comes, that sometimes is a very necessary thing that has to be brought on to human beings. Whatever reason, that's how HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world. But if you don't allow it to take place, so then you may end up, in the end, doing more harm than good in terms of a terrible prolonging of suffering for individuals. But we also believe that based on this philosophy, I have a couple of midrashic tales of where people were advised not to go to shul, so they won't have the schus of going to shul. It'll be easier to pass on things of that sort. That I remember Rabbi Moshe David Tenlo, when I was in the smicha program at YU, quoting those midrashim to us in order to show that sometimes it's proper to let people go on and die. And interestingly, when Rabbi Willig was talking about this subject with us at the CRC, not so long ago, I saw him quoting exactly the same midrashim that Rabbi Tenlo had shared with us. Very, very interesting. But Moshe Feinstein makes the important point. We'll take the question in just a moment. But Moshe Feinstein makes the important point. Look at source 17 over here. We should not confuse this notion that we're that at a certain point in time it's appropriate to let someone go with the idea that we pay any attention to what a person's age is. We believe that, I always say, you'll forgive me for this statement, I know that it's not 100% accurate in terms of how we're magdir people, how we define certain ages of zikna and seva and so forth, but I always say, looking at the age of the universe and so forth, I say 120 is young. 120 is young. I believe it, 120 is in fact young. But Lemaisa, people, you know, do get older. You should not think that because somebody is old, they deserve less treatment. Sometimes a person, unfortunately, is in a state where they're not able to live any longer, whatever the age happens to be. It says, Rav Moshe, Vidar Zakim Muflog, Shenach Nechle, the fact that a person's 105 or whatever and they're sick, Vadim Kiyon, Raposim Masha Eshik Molish Tsar. You treat them exactly like you would treat an 18-year-old. Exactly. There's no difference whatsoever. The amount of attention, the amount of treatment that you give a 105-year-old. The age is no factor whatsoever. So that's very, very important. Very, very important. Even if the person says, I can't stand my life anymore, but he's, but when I say he's well, huh?
What if I can only treat one? There's no time. There's only one doctor.
You treat whichever one arrived first. You treat whichever one arrived first. Whichever one arrived first.
Yeah, right. It's just Rob. I remember
if they both arrived first, treat the Kohen.
I remember hearing
the hospital.
Right.
In America, the hospital.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember hearing
a shout. No. That's if there's less of a chance of something to survive. But that's not evaluating. This one has a 5-year life expectancy. This one has a 25-year life expectancy. That's based on how severe the person's illness happens to be. That's a different cashbook. But here, the person could survive and be well. Okay, they're not. We don't expect them to live to 200, but they can live another a few years. They're going to be perfectly fine. They'll die of something else. So you don't take that into the cheshbon whatsoever.
I heard, in fact, to put this into a greater thing, I heard from Rabbi Yaakov Wiener and Rabbi Yosha of the following shala. Imagine a ventilator shortage, and you have the same time in the hospital. It's no question of first or second. Imagine a premature baby is born, can't breathe on their own. At the exact same moment, an elderly 98-year-old walks in, can't breathe, needs a ventilator. Who do you give the ventilator to? The premature baby? Or the 98-year-old.
So again, I told you, we're looking at whoever came first.
But let's assume it's momish
the
same second.
The same time.
So the pas can actually give it to the 98-year-old because the baby never breathed in them, doesn't have a chesed chai.
Okay, that's an interesting shiloh. Those are, again, it's a fascinating shiloh. Those are shilohs in the margins. So a lot of very interesting shilohs in the margins, and but I hear that. I do hear. Yes.
Do we ever today tell the tzibur, the family, okay, stop saying Tehillim for terminal?
We don't say it. We don't say it anymore.
I mean,
we don't say it anymore.
What we're talking about, all those cases of what stop saying Tehillim.
Some poskim will say that it's appropriate at a certain point that not to daven for a miracle. You're not supposed to daven for a miracle, but say you daven for things that are piteva. The person has a condition that is basically unrecoverable, so then the tefillah should be along the lines of what the Be'er Moshe said, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu yatzireu miyisur b'chol derech afshari. That davening is always appropriate. That davening is always appropriate. Anyway, we should all only speak about this in theory. We should all be zochet, tzavayim, aruchim, v'sharim, togos, and to be as their goal, tzedek, v'meir, v'yameh.
Amen.